Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Hello, Jeff.
On today's show, we look at good moments from 2023. You might be saying that means it will be a short show, but it's not those moments. We've talked about Alvarez and Senga before, and we've mentioned Lindor going 30-30 and Pete's home runs. So this week, we're going to talk about ourselves. Not that that's unusual. We're going to talk about our own favorite moments from the season. We each have five, and we will approach this differently. My five will be in chronological order, while Greg will count them down like Casey. Kasem, not Stengel.
Thanks, Jeff. Number five, June 8th, Braves 13, Mets 10. This was quite obviously a horrible game to lose. The Mets held leads of 6-3, 9-5, and 10-6, which indicates offense wasn't the problem. Francisco Alvarez socked two homers, and Brandon Nimmo became the 18th Met to wallop a grand slam in a loss. Though the Mets stopped scoring after the sixth inning, which included a 10th inning that began with a runner on second and nobody out, Justin Verlander started and lasted three innings, giving up five runs, the fifth of them on a bases-loaded walk. Six Met relievers followed. Five gave up at least one earned run. The other allowed an inherited runner to score. One of those bullpen pitchers, Steven Nogosek, saw his Mets career end as of this game. Another, Tommy Hunter, was done after mopping up the next night in Pittsburgh. A Met who was dropped from the team without fanfare 4 years earlier, Travis d'Arnaud, again reminded the Mets of their decision by belting a two-run homer in the eighth off Drew Smith. Names like Austin Riley, Eddie Rosario, Ronald Acuna Jr., Marcelo Zuna, Orlando Arcia, and ultimately with his three-run walk-off blast versus Hunter in the 10th, Ozzie Albies sit in boldface from this game on Baseball Reference as having driven in runs as well. This loss finished off a three-game sweep of the Mets at Truist Park, a set marked by Pete Alonso, getting hit on the wrist and eventually going in the IL, extended the Mets' losing streak to six, it would reach seven, and the Mets falling 8.5 games out of first place before the second weekend in June. So why is this in a discussion of good moments from 2023? Because it was the night I was liberated from any longer taking seriously this team as a contender to contend for what it was contending the year before. This team wasn't going to string me along any longer. Frustrate me, maybe, but no more pretending about how good this team could be. In the 63rd game of the season, they confirmed for me that they weren't going to be good enough. This, I considered then and consider now, a moral victory. My reaction to losing 13-10 to our ostensible arch rivals as one of sweet relief that none among Nogosek, Brigham, Raley, Smith, Robertson, or Hunter could provide stems back to the previous September when I developed a crick in my neck from attempting to hold my head up high throughout the Mets' month-long deflation. Mind you, the 2022 Mets didn't collapse, but the air came out of them, and I really, really, really didn't want to acknowledge it at the time. Once they got to Truist Park for the infamous series that dealt them a wild card rather than the division title that they and we spent most of a season sure was coming our way, there was nothing left to deny. It took a toll on my rooting psyche. On the eve of the wild card series we would play and lose to the Padres, I wondered to myself, how will I start over with this team next year if they don't win the World Series? The answer turned out to be by force of habit, because I'm a baseball fan with a favorite team, but my heart wasn't in it the way I knew my heart should be or could be as 2023 got underway. Not with the air of 2022's deflation hanging over it, not with the presumptuousness that had infected our worldview of a team that was supposed to win, not with the way this team was playing for most of the first 60 games that preceded June's trip to Atlanta. The surefire World Series contender Mets were 30-30 when they touched down in Georgia. 130 loomed so much larger than the other 30. It was of little surprise when the 30 on the right in the one lost columns began to dwarf the 30 on the left. As you and I planned our recording schedule for the episode that we would release on the day of the final game of the Braves series, June 8th, you expressed concern to me that if we taped early in the week, we wouldn't have anything to say about these big games. And I looked at the standings, calculated the stakes, and mentioned to you that no matter what was going on, this wasn't going to be a battle for first place. It wasn't statistically, and it wasn't spiritually. Having it over and done with by way of a horrible loss wasn't a fun experience, but for me, it was a necessary one. We, all of us, could stop pretending that what this team was or was going to be. It wasn't going to be a team fighting for first place in September or on any kind of glide path to October. We were now 30 and 33. We had 99 games left to try to enjoy the rest of the season and maybe duke it out for a wild card. I could live with that. I was free of fooling myself otherwise.
We did not look at each other's lists before the show, and I did not expect a loss to lead your list. The sweet relief of the loss of expectations is worthy of number five.
It wasn't a happy night, but I was overcome with that sense of, thank God it's over. That's a little strong. There just was this sense at the end of that game. Remember, they were ahead in all three of those games in Atlanta. They lost the previous two, not quite as spectacularly, but they lost them from ahead. I remember thinking, like, well, it would be great if they can hold on, or great if they can come back and win this in extra innings. But I just thought to myself in that moment before they lost, well, then what? Then we're 6.5 out, which again, not impossible. 8.5 out wasn't impossible, but I was just so, I don't know what I was from this team, but I was not enjoying myself watching this team, you know, with exceptions, obviously, but just as a rule. And I'd really tried not to give up on this team in the first 2 months of the year, but this was an exit. Now, mind you, giving up on the team and its chances is different from, that's it, I'm done, I'm not watching. Of course, I watched or listened to or attended every single game of the year, as I do just about every year. But yeah, I just want to be clear. I'm not celebrating the losing. I'm not saying, boy, that's good. Just the sensation I had when we came to a conclusion on the night of June 8th.
My five begins in March when there were expectations. And again, these are personal recollections, not necessarily the most substantive games. And mine is in spring training when we believed that all things were possible. I went to Florida for 2 weeks. And as soon as I got to Florida, I got COVID. Imagine that. So I was supposed to go to several games. I ended up going to one. And this was March 7th. Here's a trivia question. Who was the Mets' Rule 5 pick in last year's Rule 5 draft at the winter meetings?
Some dude on the Yankees?
Yes, close enough. Zach Greene, because he pitched in that game. And after I left in the eighth inning, the Mets were ahead and he gave up 3 runs and the game ended in a tie. But I didn't see it, so those runs weren't on me. But the reason it's number five is because in spring training, all things are possible. That game was my only spring training game. It was a beautiful night, had great seats. My wife enjoyed herself. That was her first game at the ballpark in West Palm Beach. And this was also a game during the World Baseball Classic. So there were so few recognizable names that one guy turned to me and said, are there any major leaguers on playing tonight? And I said, well, it depends on your definition of major leaguer, but Luis Guillorme is playing, et cetera. I pointed out a few names. This was also the Mets and the Astros. And I expected that to be a World Series preview. Of course, that didn't work out. But the Mets looked good that night until after I left, of course. But it was such a beautiful night. And again, in spring training, all things are possible. And I have such a warm memory of that night. So that's my number five.
Well, you can't go wrong with a tie unless, you know, it's a tiebreaker and you needed to kick the field goal and win the game. Listen, a warm night in March, don't sound too bad. Whatever the circumstances, I'm sorry you got COVID shortly thereafter. And, you know, World Baseball Classic is kind of a dirty word around here.
Yes.
Based on what happened. But I applaud you going off the regular season grid and finding a good moment in 2023. I will now resume my countdown. Number four, April 25th, Nationals 5, Mets nothing. Forget about the score or the result or the opponent. This game is here for what was revealed before the game started. one of the things we love about Steve Cohen running the Mets is the awareness he's brought to what it means to Mets fans to have the Mets aware of being the Mets. We use acknowledging team history as shorthand for that rather simple, yet in the previous regime, generally overlooked responsibility of franchise stewardship. In 2023, that meant a beautiful New York Mets Hall of Fame ceremony in early June, and the announcement in late August of a couple of more iconic players having their numbers retired next year, and some smaller but significant gestures toward the past, like having Bartolo Colon back to throw out a first pitch and retire as a Met. Woven within the fabric of our team history are the most basic threads in the Mets story, orange and blue, which is why when Cohn and the Mets signed off on whatever they received to sell ad space on their jerseys, probably somewhere between $15 and $20 million annually, based on reported estimates for that sort of thing, it was jarring to see a big block of red and white on the Mets' sleeves. Ad space on professional sports jerseys is an abomination, but, well, everybody's doing it. Who among us, even Steve Cohn, turns down $15 to $20 million a year? And the sponsor in this case, New York Presbyterian Hospitals, seems neither tacky nor shady. Maybe a medical consortium could use that money to treat the ill, but maybe marketing is important in that realm. It wasn't the worst of partnerships, but it was the worst of patches. Even if red and white were New York Presbyterian's colors, they weren't the Mets. And once Cohn got a look at the patches, he let it be known they'd be changed. And they were. After one homestand and one road trip of subliminally advertising the Phillies, those jersey ads were replaced when the Mets returned to Citi Field on April 25th by something demonstrably smaller and something rendered in blue with an orange outline. If we had to live with your name here on the Mets sleeves, this we could live with. In the right colors, the ad almost looked organic to the Mets' presentation of themselves. This was a quick course correction, cognizant of how important self-image is to us, we fans being true to the orange and blue as we are. It was one of those moves that reminded us that we weren't living with the Wilpons any longer. If jersey sleeve space was for sale when Fred and Jeff were running the show, the name of the team might have been up for bid. As was, you know, we'd be staring at a big, blocky red and white ad for years to come. Yet as happy as it makes me that this fashion faux pas was erased, it's not brand equity or a sense of team history that has me pointing to the debut of the diminutive orange and blue New York Presbyterian jersey patches as a good moment for 2023. It's realizing that looking at the original red and white patches put me in a not very good place that is only tangentially related to my Mets fandom. The Mets introduced the Philly colored ads on the morning of April 6th, what was supposed to be the day of their home opener, which they postponed in deference to a forecast of rain. It never did rain on April 6th. Something about the Mets and forecasting what was supposed to happen never really clicked in 2023. I first saw an image of the original ad patch while sitting in the back of a Lyft, while with my wife on our way to her appointment with her oncologist. We didn't know what her oncologist was going to tell us. 10 days earlier, Stephanie had gone into our local hospital, not New York Presbyterian, for a procedure deemed necessary when imaging in February showed the kind of cells that you bring in an oncologist for. This was not something you ever want to hear, but we heard it and we had to deal with it. The procedure lay ahead of us throughout spring training. At its best, the coming of the baseball season served as a modest distraction and the promise of brighter, warmer days, regardless of record. But mostly it was immaterial to me. I wasn't particularly interested in thinking about the upcoming baseball season as March went along. I absented myself from this podcast for a couple of weeks because I honestly couldn't devote myself to treating a significant who would be the 13th pitcher or 26th player on the 2023 Mets roster. The procedure took place the Monday before opening day. It went well, and Stephanie was home after one night in the hospital. She rested up while we watched the Mets commence their season in Miami that Thursday, March 30th, getting used to the pitch clock and noticing how off everything seemed about the game in the early days of the rules. Or maybe we were just antsy about April 6th, the day we'd get the full report from her surgery. We were in a Lyft come April 6th because I was a little too nervous to drive us to the oncologist. I thought I detected something off when I started my car and didn't want to take any chances. The car was fine, but I didn't mind calling on a relief driver. Thus, we're sitting in the backseat of this other car, and I'm killing time scrolling through Twitter on my phone, and I see this big, blocky, red and white patch that the Mets are gleefully announcing will be sewn onto every one of their uniforms, and I'm distracted enough to say to Stephanie, "Oh my God, look at this thing." It was nice to have something else to think about besides where we were going. Yet, where we were going turned out to be a pretty good place. because when we got there, the oncologist uttered the magic words, "Your labs were better than your biopsy." And Stephanie was officially no longer in the woods. There'd be continued recovery from the surgery and a little in the way of minor treatments as spring turned into summer, but no bad news. You never feel free and clear of this sort of thing, and there are still periodic doctor's visits. But the home opener that was preemptively rained out turned out to be our best day of the season, a season that proceeded blessedly normally for us, including a couple of trips to the ballpark together, something I wouldn't have dared to take as a given before the season began. And the replacement of the blocky red and white patch with the reasonable sized orange and blue patch stands as a symbol of that triumph. Because now, every time I see a picture or a highlight from earlier April with that red and white patch, it takes me back to the hour before we got the best news we could hope for, to the uncertainty and the gray skies and the hope that, as of that hour, lacked resolution. Not having to look at that blocky red and white patch for the rest of the season or in future seasons was the best gift Steve Cohen could have given to this Mets fan under the circumstances of how our most recent season began. I suppose the owner could have turned down the deal to have a jersey sponsor to begin with, but I don't suppose you get to be in a position to own a major league ball club, even the one for which you grew up rooting, by not accepting between $15 and $20 million a year for just a tiny piece of your sleeve or perhaps something deeper within you.
Some things are more important than baseball. We don't always remember that. So even a 5-0 loss can bring back good memories. Thank you, Greg. My next three are from May. I was thinking about the Mets May, not Trevor May, who just retired, the month of May, because we didn't know then what Greg just mentioned in June. Here, I'm citing three highlights of the season from May, when already in this series, I've provided two examples in our review of 2023 of the Mets' incompetence from May. The Detroit series, when we were surprised that a good Mets team was swept in three games by a bad team, when it turned out that it was simply one bad team beating another bad team. And the May 15 game against Washington, when Buck looked ahead to the fall and conceded the game in advance by pitching Dave Peterson and his 8-plus ERA instead of Justin Verlander to give Verlander and Scherzer an extra day off, which didn't help the Mets, but it helped Texas make the World Series and Houston the ALCS. But we're talking about good things here, and we didn't know how badly the season was going to turn out in May, so three of my five are from May. The first, in the first game of that same four-game series against Washington, as part of the series where you remember the second game. The second game had a four-hour rain delay, but I went to the first game on May 12, and it was a gem. The thing was, I was extra cranky. Greg knows that when I go to a game and things don't go well, I can sometimes use language I don't use on this show. I get to be a little cranky, maybe a lot cranky. And I was that way. And even my older son was surprised because it was a glorious night. We had wonderful seats. McGill was pitching, and that doesn't usually put me in a good mood. And the Mets fell behind 2-0 until they had the bases loaded and Francisco Lindor came up. And he hit a 3-run single. He cleared the bases with a single. How is that possible? Great base running all around, but especially from Nimmo, who scored from first. The official score ruled that Lindor made second on a throw, so it was a bases clearing 3-run single. McGill, it turned out, had a solid start. Drew Smith came in relief of a tiring Robertson and got the save. It was a great night with my son, and it was a great night seeing the Mets win 3-2 on May 12th.
That was the third 3-run single in Mets history. This was shared widely. I remember one of the games, Edgardo Alfonso had a 3-run single against the Giants in 1997. This one I don't remember. Tug McGraw, pitchers used to bat, even relievers sometimes, had a 3-run single, I believe it was 1970. The Mets had three-run singles against them in their past, the most famous, at least to me, Pete Rose did it to Dwight Gooden in 1986, kind of ended the spell of Dwight Gooden. Kurt Manwaring in 1988, the same day that Greg Jeffries came up to much acclaim. And Roy Oswalt, a pitcher against the Mets for the Astros in 2002. So I remember that 3-run single. So you saw something pretty damn unusual. And I would think even a bear stalking the stands at Nationals Park would calm down, use nice language, and be very appreciative. Because I'm going to stay in May. Hopefully we will not stumble into each other, because there was one period. Number three, May 18th. Mets 3, Rays 2. Yes, I actually picked some Met wins, believe it or not. The New York Mets produced one magical week during the 2023 season. This game was its glue. After a slog that saw them underperform versus competition deemed not up to their lofty level, thus dragging them down to a plane no one watching them daily would consider any better than average, the Mets welcomed the Tampa Bay Rays into Citi Field on May 16th. These were the first place Tampa Bay Rays from the American League East, the division where everybody was considered above average. The Rays had been setting the pace since day one, going a record-tying 13-0 to start the season and barely cooling off from there. When they arrived in Queens, the Rays were 32-11. For reference sake, the mighty 1986 Mets at the same point in their schedule were 31-12. Sure enough, the Rays started off this series by pouncing on Justin Verlander for 5 runs in 5 innings and posting an 8-5 win. The Mets made it cosmetically close in the final inning, but who would put stock in late runs in a lost cause? The next night, May 17th, unfolded as a different Mets starting pitching story for 6 innings, with Kodai Senga mostly wriggling out of trouble and striking out 12 over 6 innings. He was behind 1-0 when he was taken out, a deficit that increased to 2-0 in the 7th. Before you could mutter, same old, the Mets reverted to their more recent habit from the night before and started scoring late. A 2-run homer in the 7th from Mark Vientos, who had just been called up, to tie the game at 2, and a 3-run homer with 2 out in the 9th from fellow rookie Francisco Alvarez to tie the game at 5. The Rays had kept scoring too, but they hadn't definitively headed off the Mets. Sure looked like they did in the 10th, though, once they put 2 more runs on the board. Yet here came Pete Alonso to smash a 3-run homer in the bottom of the 10th and win the LFGM thing 8-7. What a lift. And as the series finale got underway the next afternoon, I pretty much expected the thriller from the night before to linger as an aberration, because who could repeat that sort of thing? When I ask who, I mean the Mets, and when I say asked, it was rhetorical, because despite the exhilaration of the outcome of the night before, they were still the 2023 Mets, who'd been disappointing us continuously for weeks, and these were the 2023 Rays, soaring high above all of Major League Baseball. These Rays were going to lose a series to these Mets? Turned out these Mets had a whole other kind of ballgame in mind for the matinee that closed out the series on May 18th. Behind not the celebrated Verlander nor the intriguing Senga, but the rapidly all too familiar Tylor Megill, the Mets hung surprisingly tough for every one of the 9 innings played. The Rays took a methodical 1-run lead in the first. The Mets just as methodically built a run right back. The Mets couldn't do much against Rays starter Taj Bradley for a couple of innings. The Rays didn't touch Megill during the same time frame. Between the bottom of the 4th and the top of the 6th, the teams exchanged solo home runs. Alonso for us, Josh Lowe for them. In the bottom of the 6th, the Rays had replaced Bradley with Zach Littell, and the Mets played comparative little ball. A leadoff single from Jeff McNeil, a one-out single from Brett Beatty that sent McNeil scurrying to third, and Tommy Pham not getting the ball out of the infield, yet his ball rolled slowly enough toward third to score the squirrel. The Mets took a 3-2 lead into the 7th, and they kept it. I kept expecting them to give it away, but no. Megill had gone 6, or the modern equivalent of 9, and handed it over to Brooks Raley for 2 shutout innings, and Raley handed that over to David Robertson, who closed it out. It was all rather simple when you look at it as just one game. A 3-2 Mets win. By my count, with a little calculating help from Baseball Reference, the Mets have won 309 3-2 regular season games in their history, the most common score by which they prevailed when they prevailed. This iteration of 3-2 shouldn't have stood out any more than the other 308. Yet, within the context of the unfolding and unraveling of the 2023 season, it did. The night before, with its slam-bang pivot points and polar bear resolution and the free runner on second gimmick, it felt almost contrived. Welcome, but not something readily repeatable. This was a nice, tight day game. It took 2:22 to complete. The kind a decent baseball team wins, even from the team acknowledged at that interval of the season as the best in the sport. The Mets had avoided overcoming their lapses and the competition so often that I'd forgotten they were capable of topping a quality or any opponent in this manner. because it was a midweek day game, I couldn't pay attention to every single pitcher's swing. I glimpsed at some of it on TV early, had to run errands with the radio on and off in the middle, and wasn't able to focus on it totally until the end. Mostly, I knew the sun was out and the Mets weren't. Slowly, I became convinced the Mets wouldn't necessarily lose to the Rays, a conviction that held until they absolutely won. That sense was much different from how I'd processed most of the season until this particular Thursday afternoon. Even on Wednesday night, with all the home runs, I sort of expected everything to go wrong. In short, this game was a vibe. It turned the night before from aberrant to the start of the week of the year. Our modest winning streak of two became three with a Friday night come-from-behind slugfest that hammered the visiting Guardians in 10 innings, 10-9. That was breathtaking and exciting, as were the two wins in the day-night doubleheader Sunday that was played after rain on Saturday. Those victories over Cleveland had Scherzer and Verlander pitching at their best, and the Mets getting key hits late, and the club extending its winning streak to five. Every one of the five wins saw the Mets shake off a deficit. There was so much to like about this team for a change. What I really liked best, though, was that day in the sun on Thursday. I needed that vibe.
Too bad there wasn't more of that. Sometimes it's clear that Greg and I do have the same recollections, the same mind. And sometimes it could just be a case that there weren't that many good moments in 2023. My number three was the night before Greg's number three, May 17th, Mets 8, Tampa 7. Vientos hits a two-run home run in the seventh. Alvarez ties it with a two-out, three-run homer in the ninth, and Pete walks it off with a three-run homer in the 10th. Gary yells, one to grow on for the New York Mets. The only thing that really grew as the days went on was disappointment, but we didn't know that. May 17th, Mets 8, Tampa 7, my number three.
Listen, I think we both agree this was the best time of the year to be a Mets fan, not counting before we knew what it was like to be a Mets fan in 2023. So we wound up in the same series and really probably could have picked any one of those five games and said, what a great day to be a Mets fan, which we needed badly. I'm moving on to number two, August 17th, Mets 4, Cardinals 2. Jose Quintana deserved better than the Mets season he walked into after the All-Star break. I mean, we all deserve better than this particular Mets season. But here was this proven veteran lefty signed to be an essential part of a contender, only to get injured in spring training, not celebrating a World Baseball Classic contest. And by the time he's fully healthy and ready to pitch, the team he thought he joined in December was about to disassemble itself. Quintana shows up for real in July and pitches like the kind of winner a contender would salivate over. Yet the Mets aren't a contender, and Quintana is, start after start, a hard luck loser. Quintana's on the mound in St. Louis on a Thursday night with neither team going anywhere in the standings, and he's doing what he's been doing for the past month. He's getting batters out. Happily, Adam Wainwright, in the last time he'll ever face the Mets, he'd faced them enough for the past 18 years, particularly in October of 2006, isn't getting nearly as many Mets out, and the Met offense has furnished Jose a rare lead of 3-0. Our southpaw perhaps tires a bit in the seventh and gives up a homer, then a walk and a single, and is replaced. One of his runners scores, yet he is still the pitcher of record on the long side when the inning ends. When we get to the ninth, our 3-2 lead becomes 4-2 via an unlikely source, Tim LoCastro, who usually pinch runs, but here leads off with his first home run of the season, his first home run as a Met. It's a little insurance for the greater good, but also a marker in the quest for the cause of the night, namely getting Quintana his first win of the season, and his first win as a Met. The only thing that can blow this for Jose now is the thing that blows things for the Mets chronically, the Mets bullpen. Maybe that's an exaggeration. We had some decent relievers in 2023, including Brooks Raley and Adam Ottavino, either of whom you'd trust more than you wouldn't if they come on in the bottom of the ninth to preserve a two-run lead, except they are not called on. They pitched the day before, throwing 14 and 17 pitches apiece. Plus, Raley had thrown 17 the day before that. By whatever calculus is applied, the ninth inning and the save situation at hand is assigned to Trevor Gott. What was that we were saying about the only thing that can blow this for Quintana? Trevor Gott had been a Met reliever since early July and had not inserted himself within any Mets fans' circle of trust. Nor was he usually somebody the manager lined up for the inning that required the most trust, a ninth, with a lead of three or fewer runs hanging in the balance. The Mets closer of record, Edwin Diaz, was lost before the season began, which might have something to do with the season having been lost then too. The Mets' next incumbent in the role, David Robertson, did a splendid enough job to merit irresistible attraction on the trade market, so he wasn't available either. No Raley, no Ottavino. Fine, we'll try it with Gott. What's the worst that could happen? That would be answered in future outings. But not this night at Busch Stadium. Trevor put a couple of runners on base and had to face the perennially dangerous Paul Goldschmidt as the potential winning run. But the Cardinals were having their own type of over before it was over a year, and Gott bested Goldschmidt, striking him out and stranding those runners. Just like that, Trevor Gott had his first save of the year and first save as a Met. Wait a second, I thought. Gott has his first save as a Met, saving the 4-2 victory that became Quintana's first win as a Met, which was fortified when LoCastro hit his first homer as a Met. My Stengel sense was tingling. Three personal Met firsts in the same game. It must have happened before, but when? I might not have noticed any of this had I not decided once the season was officially given up on by management that Jose Quintana was my favorite Met of the moment, pitching so well start after start and going unrewarded every time. All that sophistication about not fretting over pitcher wins that we'd steeled ourselves with during Jacob deGrom's brilliant run of losses and no decisions went out the window. I'd wanted Jose to get a W, so I was hyper aware that he had one in his grasp. LoCastro hitting his first Met homer was sure to get my attention because one Met homer is one of those stats I am diligent about tracking. As soon as a player hits his very first homer as a Met, I add his name to a list. As soon as a Met hits his second homer, I delete it. The ones who remain stay in the one Met homer club forever, starting with four 1962 Mets, Gus Bell, Hobie Landreth, John Demeritt, and Rick Hersher, and running through more recent one-and-dones like Robinson Chirinos, Mason Williams, Travis Blankenhorn, and Khalil Lee in this decade. Why do I do this? So when a Tim LoCastro comes along and suddenly homers, I don't have to wonder, it must have happened before, but when? I know when. I keep lots of lists so I can know lots of things like this on the off chance I will feel a need to know them. But the combination of a first Mets win and a first Mets homer embellished by a first Mets save? I didn't have a list for that. Late on this Thursday night, after soaking in what I had just witnessed, I would have to build it myself, and I would have to build it right now. I spent a few hours in the company of Baseball Reference, unlocking the key to figuring this out. Scan the save columns from every Mets season. Look for Mets saves marked with one in parentheses. Check to see if it is accompanied by a first Met win. Then click on the box score and see if anybody hit a first Met home run in the same game where the first Met win and first Met save occurred. If you know your way around the site and have developed a feel for Mets history, it's really not that hard. But finding a precedent for Quintana, one, Gott, one, and LoCastro, one, all in the same game, took some doing. It didn't happen in 1962, when every Met was doing something as a Met for the first time, though there weren't a lot of wins, let alone saves in those days. It didn't happen in 1963 either, or 1964, or 1965, or 1966. You'd figure a troika of newcomers would all make their mark in the same game once in the first 5 years, particularly with all the newcomers have constituted an expansion team in flux. Finally, I struck orange and blue gold on April 13th, 1967. I mean, did I ever. The first time it happened, first Met win, first Met save, and first Met homer happened in Tom Seaver's first start in the majors. The kicker is the first win didn't belong to Seaver, but the reliever who followed him that day at Shea, Chuck Estrada, a veteran who had come over in the offseason. Estrada was the beneficiary of a rally that succeeded his entry into the game in the sixth when the score was tied, so he became the pitcher of record on the long side. Manager Wes Westrum had pinch hit for Estrada to make that rally pay off, so he needed what we later call a closer, and brought in Ron Taylor to finish off the Pittsburgh Pirates, which Taylor did, preserving the 3-2 win that was built in part on a home run off the bat of Jerry Buchik in the second inning. Buchik, like Taylor and Estrada, had been acquired prior to the 1967 season. This was the second game of the year. The Mets had lost their first game, as they literally always lost their first game in their first years. No way this couldn't be Estrada's first win as a Met or Taylor's first save as a Met. And Buchik hadn't homered on opening day, so there I had it. The first instance of these three firsts in the same game in Mets history. The second? Exactly a week later. And this time the win belonged to Tom Seaver, his first in the majors, therefore his first as a Met. Seaver went 7 1/3 against the Cubs at Shea and left with a lead. He turned over to rookie Don Shaw, who as yet had not saved a game as a Met. But on this day, April 20th, 1967, He surely did. The lead he protected was built not only on Seifert's pitching, but the slugging of Tommy Davis, who'd belted his first Met home run in the fourth. I knew the dates of Seifert's debut and inaugural W, but I had no idea other firsts were attached to them. I never cared that other firsts were attached to them until I realized what was going on regarding Quintana and LoCastro and Gott. What I wouldn't have conceived was that between April 20th, 1967 and August 17th, 2023, it never happened at all. I mean, never. No trifecta of a first Met win, a first Met save, and a first Met homer crossed the finish line side by side by side in the same game for 56 years. Trust me, I thoroughly checked every Met season twice. I discovered something I was certain nobody else knew, and I shared it as best I could in the days ahead. This is the sort of thing I live for as a fan. The Mets winning big games and me cheering in response too. But this really is what turns me on. Noticing Met things, delving into Met things, making a thing of Met things, which is where a subscription to the newspapers.com archives comes in handy for learning what was being said about rookie Tom Seaver when he wasn't yet universally praised as terrific, or understanding how the not-quite-official save rule was handled in the years saves were growing into a glamour category on a par with wins and home runs. I live for not just these statistical oddities, but comprehending their context and tracing a line forward from a couple of starts a week apart in 1967 to a night in 2023 and traversing as many tangents as possible en route. Again, in your scorecards, that's a win for Jose Quintana, a save for Trevor Gott, a home run for Tim LoCastro, and the fuel that keeps this fan going, no matter what kind of season it is.
I remember your delight at that, and I shared in your delight, partially because it was so unique and partially because it made you so happy. Your mention of Trevor Gott brought back not one of my favorite moments from the Met season, but from one of my favorite moments from Faith and Fear and Flushing, which you wrote. It was about a game the Mets played in Washington in September. They lost. The Mets led 2-0 through six. Jose Buto got tired. Trevor Gott came into the game, and soon the Mets lead was gone, and it was 2-2. What you wrote in Faith and Fear and Flushing was the Nationals didn't score in the eighth inning because Trevor Gott didn't pitch the eighth inning. I thought that was fantastic. It was subtle, it was biting, and it was true.
And it was provable.
Yes. My fourth best moment of the season is also from May, my third game in May, and it's a nondescript game. You probably don't remember it. It didn't really matter. The Mets lost the next two games in Denver. I was at the first game in Denver, May 25th. The Mets won 5-2. Lindor hit a home run in the first inning. The Mets had four runs from Lindor in that game. Scherzer had one of his few good games of the season that night, so that was a surprise. And the aforementioned Adam Ottavino got the save. What made the game memorable was attending the game in Denver with one of our listeners, Dave Metz Outsider. It was a pleasant evening, great company, and it was a solid Mets win, a memorable moment from 2023.
Well, you couldn't ask for anything more other than oxygen, I suppose, that high up, but that's great. You got to meet Dave. And all the other things you said, Rocky Mountain High indeed, huh?
That's right.
Number one, July 20th, White Sox 6, Mets 2. That hooky sitcom premise of a long married couple renewing its vows actually has some real life efficacy, I discovered on a Thursday afternoon in midsummer 2023. The couple in this case was me and attending Mets games. I first wed myself to the experience of going to Shea Stadium on July 11th, 1973. We had our ups and downs, me and the team that I played inside the ballpark in Flushing, but I loved that place, and I believed it loved me. There was enough love in the room that it transferred surprisingly easily into what had been Shea's parking lot when a different facility sprung up to replace the original in 2009. Citi Field and I had our ups and downs, too. Our relationship was more fraught than the one I shared with Shea, but that will happen with change. One thing hadn't changed after 50 years. I wanted to go to the game. I don't always want to go to the game. But I do enough, even after a half century. I wanted to go to the game of July 20th, 2023, not just for whatever pleasures the Mets and their opponents might provide, but to celebrate my 50th anniversary of going to Mets games and do it in a manner most befitting the way I went my first time. My first time was with a day camp group, which made sense because I was a day camper. I'd have gone sooner than 1973 had circumstances allowed me, but it didn't work out. I had to wait until I was 10, even though I'd been a Mets fan since I was six. The date our camp group was going seared itself into my brain in advance and has never left me. Every year on July 11th, I think it's my anniversary. It would have been perfect had the Mets been home on July 11th on my 50th anniversary so I could commemorate it precisely. That didn't happen. But July 20th, 2023 was close enough. I wanted a midweek day game just like in July of 1973. I wanted a day camp vibe. And because day camp groups still go to Mets games, I found myself sitting with my back to who knows how many hundreds of day campers, all of them in voluble voice. Were we as excited then as these kids sounded now? We should have been. I'm a quiet sort in public, but inside I'm pretty sure I yelled plenty about being at my first Mets game. I knew who I had to go with to my 50th anniversary game. Me. I had a lot of great times in 2023 at Citi Field with people close to me, but this was a mission for me and me alone. Even if I would come back from the game and tell everybody who'd listen what it was like, I had to feel it as a party of one. I wasn't alone in my day camp group in 1973. We were, after all, a group. But I know I was the only one somehow certain that I'd be back to celebrate this occasion in roughly the same spot 50 years later. Somebody I respect, somebody whom I had just told about an idea I had for writing something, this was a while ago, suggested my notion might work better if I got out of my head a little more. He might have been right, but I also know that my head is where my season tickets have been for as long as I can remember. It's where I've taken in every Met season. It worked for me on my 50th anniversary. My head provides a scintillating view. My 50th anniversary game, as I came to call it, is as close as I'll ever come to sitting inside and wandering around Shea Stadium again. Over Citi Field's first 15 years, I've intermittently slipped into the habit of pointing somewhere on the field commensurate with where something happened in what is now the parking lot and implicitly calling it Shea. I was here when such and such happened in some year where nothing happened here except the parking of cars. Shea and Citi, despite my eternal misgivings that the latter usurped the former, have functionally melded into one. On July 20th, 2023, Citi was Shea for me, and Shea was alive all around me again. I was just having a day in the best sense of the word. The Mets lost, just as they had 50 years before. Oh well, it didn't keep me from coming back after 1973, and it still hasn't. It occurred to me later that given my age and retention of dates and events, that if I'm lucky, I'll be consciously living through lots of 50th anniversaries in the course of the rest of my life. I doubt I'll be going out of my way to return to more or less the spots where they happened and seeking a day to try to relive those dates and those events. Not everything is your first Mets game or the 50th anniversary thereof.
My number five involves a late night game. When you're younger, you say, I can't wait to get older, and then I can stay up as late as I want. And then when you're older, you can't stay up that late. On July 5th, I managed to stay awake for the whole game. Mets at Arizona. They're down 1-0. It was a blah game. I was fighting sleep. I shut my computer. I stood with two outs. And then Alvarez hit a home run to tie it. And then I sat down, put open the computer again. Beatty singled. And then Canna drove him in. The Mets held on in the bottom of the ninth. The Mets win 2-1. A thrilling win. You never know what's going to happen until the last out is made. Even in 2023, that was proven to us. Mets 2, Arizona 1 on July 5th.
Okay, so that makes our combined record 6-3-1 for the best moments.
So even in our 10 best moments, the Mets only go 6-3-1.
But it speaks well to the experience of Mets fandom that you can feel something that stays with you and means something to you, even without something as presumably necessary for your happiness as a Mets win. Now and then, in a great season, sometimes you can really find a way to enjoy something that happened in a loss and not feel like you've been suckered. I remember in 2006, the game that Lasting's Millage hit his first home run, where he does the high-fiving with the fans down the line, going back to his position in right field, which became a stupid controversy. Mets came back at least twice in that game. This was, I think, in extra innings. In fact, I remember I was at the ballet that day, which is a strange sentence to have said, but there you go. So I wasn't able to follow the game, and phones weren't quite what, at least my phone wasn't quite what it would be in years later. I would have to step outside during intermissions and between acts, whatever, pick up on what was going on. And I heard something about last innings, millage, home run, extra innings. Like, what? I like, what's going on? And then suddenly the game was over. But at the end of the year, I remember looking back on that moment, that day, and saying, and again, because we had 97 wins in a division title and a playoff series win and all kinds of excitement, I could sit back and say, you know what? That was one of the best days of the year. And I was sorry that they lost that day, but it stays with me probably more than a lot of the wins that I ranked higher in those days. So, you know, wins are preferable. Absolutely. Oh, too bad we couldn't choose from among 162. Too bad that between us, we had one good memory from after July. But we probably could have stretched a little bit and looked around, but we had a baseball season. You know what? I feel better about it now than I did living through it after talking about it for a spell.
NLT has now completed our three-part review of the 2023 season, and we feel confident in saying that it went better than the actual Mets season. NLT now goes into off-season mode, so we will be taking next week off. We'll be back in the first full week of November. So until then, we thank you for listening. I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. For tour dates and more, check them out on Bandcamp.